Welcome back to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. Today's program is titled Good Reeds, where we are exploring the woodwind instruments whose sound is produced with a reed mouthpiece and some of the great music written for these reed instruments. For this episode, we are going instrument by instrument instead of the usual era-by-era approach that we take in most of our episodes. We have already discussed the single-reed clarinet and the double-reed oboe. In this half of the show, we will talk about two other double-reed instruments, the English horn and the bassoon. First, let's talk about the oboe's slightly larger sibling, the English horn. Because its fingerings are the same as the oboe, with the only exception that the instrument itself sounds lower, most oboists also play the English horn, which is sometimes regarded as a tenor oboe. Now, this instrument is neither English nor a horn in the traditional brass instrument sense. In the Germanic language of medieval Central Europe, it was called Englisches Horn or Angelic Horn, an adjective that also could mean English. It certainly has a beautiful, perhaps angelic sound. One of the most famous English horn moments in music history is quite angelic, you could say, and it's the main theme of the second movement of Dvorak's New World Symphony. Here it is, performed by the Philadelphia Orchestra with Wolfgang Sawallisch conducting. That was Wolfgang Sawallisch conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra, performing the second movement of Antonín Dvořák's Symphony No. 9 from the New World. The statement of the main theme is presented by the English horn, an instrument which consists of a double reed mouthpiece, much like the higher oboe. Another double reed instrument that's even larger than this English horn or this tenor oboe, and therefore one that produces the lowest sound of this double reed family, is the bassoon. You might know the bassoon from Paul Dukas' The Sorcerer's Apprentice. When the bassoon is featured alone, it might have a comical flavor. Perhaps it left you with a hint of that in the Dukas piece. But it can also produce lyrical tones up in its higher register. This is evident in the opening of Igor Stravinsky's groundbreaking ballet from 1913, The Rite of Spring. The opening bassoon passage is in the highest part of the instrument's register, so it creates a different sound than if Stravinsky just had an oboe play it in its mid to low range, for instance. Listen to this. So that was the first movement from Igor Stravinsky's ballet, The Rite of Spring, performed by the Cleveland Orchestra, conducted by Lorne Mazel. At the beginning and the very end of that short movement, is a high and difficult solo passage for the bassoon. Now, you would have heard other wind instruments, many other wind instruments featured in that movement in the other parts of the orchestra. You heard a piccolo clarinet, a very high-sounding clarinet, and a very low-sounding clarinet, a bass clarinet. Stravinsky was using all sorts of different woodwind instruments and woodwind colors in that opening movement. But mainly the reason I played that was so you could hear the beginning and the end, that high bassoon solo, and it's a very unique sound even for the bassoon when it's up that high. This bass double reed instrument can play these lyrical lines like what Stravinsky wrote, jovial lines like the theme in Dukas' The Sorcerer's Apprentice. It can also sound ponderous, which is how Sergei Prokofiev uses it in Peter and the Wolf, a piece that introduces several main instruments of the orchestra by assigning those instruments to specific characters in a narrated tale. The bassoon, in Prokofiev's work, represents Peter's grandfather. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Good Reeds. We are exploring the woodwind instruments whose sound is produced with a reed mouthpiece, and we're exploring some of the great music written for these reed instruments. We talked at length about the clarinet, the oboe, the English horn, and the bassoon. I want to play a piece now that puts all these together, and it features many of these reed instruments prominently in the texture, among other instruments of the orchestra. This is a piece by Béla Bartók, his Concerto for Orchestra. I'll talk more about this in a future program, but basically it's a five-movement work that treats the single orchestral instruments in a soloistic manner throughout the entire piece. In the second movement, what Bartók does is he puts them in pairs. This movement's titled Game of the Pairs. Bartók explores a melody by expressing it merely through a pair of bassoons first, then a pair of oboes, then a pair of clarinets, then a pair of flutes, a wind instrument that we're saving for another episode, you might have noticed, and finally a pair of muted trumpets. And once that theme is presented in all those pairs, then we have the end of the first section. This piece is in three sections, or a ternary form, a three-part form, where the first and third sections are basically the same, and the middle section is a contrasting section. For the middle section, you'll hear the brass play a quiet chorale or hymn-like section, and then when the A theme comes back, when that first section comes back, the main melody is presented again, but this time, the pair of instruments is joined by another of the same. So what happens is you'll hear three bassoons, two of them doing the original parts, the original pairing on the melody, and then the other doing a running descant-like phrase alongside it. So here is Game of the Pairs, the second movement of Béla Bartók's Concerto for Orchestra, performed by Fritz Reiner and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Fritz Reiner and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra performing the second movement of Béla Bartók's Concerto for Orchestra, The Game of the Pairs. Today on Music for Life, we are exploring some of the great music composed for the woodwind instruments, whose sound is produced using a reed mouthpiece. As a section in the orchestra, these instruments can add charming, comical, athletic, or colorful characteristics to the symphonic sound. Unlike the strings, the various wind instruments are easy to distinguish one from another because they each have a distinct timbre or tone color. They are usually used only two at a time in the orchestra, maybe three in a section. But there is another common ensemble where the woodwinds, the reed instruments in particular, are far more numerous, and that is the wind band or the symphonic band. These military bands took on more of a concert function, and subsequently more popularity, due to the efforts of the mid-19th century American bandleader John Philip Sousa. Now they are a staple in the American musical landscape. They are also quite a common musical ensemble for secondary schools across America. And that leads us into our Classroom Corner segment, where we explore different methods and curricula for introducing young people to music. Over half the instruments in the wind band, in this kind of ensemble, are woodwind reed instruments. So it's not uncommon for band directors or band teachers to be woodwind players themselves. So I'm back here with oboist David Price, who has spent much of his life, much of his career in music, teaching band in the public school systems. David, how long did you teach band in public schools? 30 years. Yeah. Wow. So you have a storied past there, I'm sure. A lot to share with us here today.
Yeah, a lot.
Well, first, what's the advantage of a school having a band program over an orchestra program? Why do schools opt for band?
I'm going to guess that the reason schools are so prolific about band programs is the fact that they're easily movable and can play for different functions like athletic events.
Oh, like so football games, you got a football program, so you need a band.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to march an orchestra.
Right. March the cellos the violas and such. Okay. So that's your understanding of why in the American public school system.
And probably the influence of John Philip Sousa.
Right.
Of course, back in the 1800s, every large corporation had their own band. Not just the community, but these companies had their own bands, and they gave concerts, they had competitions. So band music was, playing an instrument was much more the thing to do back in the 1800s than now.
Hmm. Well, what are the advantages that students glean from being in a band program? What's the value educationally, musically, just in terms of life's enrichment?
Yeah, well, it's seemingly been proven that students that are in band or orchestra, actually, or chorus, seem to have a greater ability to do math and it's also a good chance to be in a community and get along with each other. Even though you may not like the other flute player that's sitting next to you, you are all headed toward a common goal.
Hmm.
And if you don't work together, whether you like each other or not, you will fail.
So it's teaching a team.
Yeah, it's community spirit. It's how to get along with other people, whether you like their values or not.
Right. And so that's something that they can learn in mm-hmm. the band program. And that's something that's a little bit outside the scope of, say, an academic benefit.
Right.
It's more of just a life enriching
right.
benefit.
I can go to my math class and I can accelerate at any pace that I want to. I can fail that class. I can get an A++. In band, if I fail by not being able to play my music, I bring down the rest of the organization.
Mm.
And of course, you know, there's beauty in performing music. And the experience of starting a particular piece of music in the first rehearsal, and it may not sound too good, it's kind of raw, and then at the end when you're ready for a performance or a contest, it sounds great. There's a lot of self-satisfaction in that.
Right.
It teaches us how to set goals.
Right. And it sounds like you just said, it's teaching them that others are dependent mm-hmm. on their success. Like you said, if they fail math, no one else is going to be brought down necessarily.
No.
But if they fail, you know, the second bassoon part, then...
It hurts the whole group.
Right, right.
So, and the music groups in school have both male and female.
Right.
You know, the football team will just have, right now at least, have boys.
Right. So you're saying the team spirit that band uh-huh. teaches, it's even... It can even go beyond what athletics can teach because of the co-educational component, the
yes.
fact there's male and female together.
I still have students finding me on Facebook and telling me how much band meant to them and not just the musical experience.
Right. That's inspiring.
Yeah.
Well, that's certainly some of the positives to being a band teacher. What about some of the challenges you faced, say, either from being a band director mm-hmm. or from it being in public school systems? Or what were some of the various challenges you faced?
Well, of course, lack of money, because it's incredibly expensive to have a band program. Mm. When you're talking about one concert tuba costing $6,000 to $8,000, and you need six.
Right.
You know, but then you also need six tubas for them to take home and practice. Mm. And that's just the tubas. Bassoons... Well, they're the most expensive instrument in the band.
Yeah.
They can run $20,000 to $30,000.
Wow.
And, you know, if you buy a professional oboe like mine, you're talking about $10,000. Of course, not too many bands have a professional oboe. They'll have one that may cost around six. But still, $6,000 for an instrument, you know, and they have to go sell candy door to door. You know,
right.
One of these days, our public education, our education system is going to have enough money, and maybe our military will go door to door selling light bulbs.
Sounds like a plan. Sounds like you got some good policy ideas
yeah.
there. Well, so that's definitely a challenge that you face. You know,
yeah.
instruments are expensive.
Yeah.
And then public schools obviously have limited funding. So that's a challenge you're facing.
Yeah.
Like you said, you know, maybe six to eight tubas, and then the kids would need one at home too because they can't lug it back and forth.
Right.
So that certainly is a
costly
endeavor.
Of course, most of the kids in the band own their own instruments.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that helps.
Yeah.
Right.
There'd be no way.
Right. Well, what are some of the other challenges other than just, you know, funding or monetary challenges that you face?
Scheduling. Sometimes they will schedule a class that maybe like the seniors need for graduation, and they'll put it like right next to band and you lose students.
And you lose seniors or
yeah.
something, right?
You're pretty much better players. And dealing with administrators, dealing with parents, it's not unlike being a football coach and somebody coming up saying, "Coach, my kid should have been playing quarterback."
Mm.
You know.
So you're dealing with that element as well.
Yes.
Right.
But luckily, it's not much.
And then there's also, I think you've mentioned this before to me, the fluctuation of the group from year to year.
Oh, yeah.
And that that impacting what you teach them and what music you do. Is that right?
Right. One year you could have, like one year when I was teaching at PC West, the first five chair clarinet players were the first five chairs in the Allstate band. So my clarinet section was incredible. Next year, you know, they could graduate. Next year, they could be mediocre. So you could, the challenge is then to find music to play for concert and contest that fits what you have talent-wise.
Right.
Just like, again, the football coach may have a great certain players one season. The next season, that could be his weakest spot.
Right, because they graduate and then replacements come up.
So you have to come up with plays or music that fits what you have.
Right.
It's not like a professional orchestra where you can play whatever.
Right. And then you're trying to make it where they can handle it, but also you're probably making sure it's a little bit challenging for them to push them out of their comfort zone and have them learn.
Yeah, you try to inspire them, you know, to, this is a great piece and it's going to sound great. Like if you can come up with a recording of it so they can hear what it's going to sound like when it finishes, that helps.
So the ways that you inspire them, you try to inspire them about the music itself?
Right, right.
And how important is it to inspire them in terms of like their actual achievement? Like how important is that positive reinforcement that you have to give as a band director?
Kids at that age, like high school and middle school, they grasp hold more of trophies and ratings than they do the aesthetic part of performing.
Mm-hmm.
Even though if you're having them play a great piece of music, it'll eventually get into them.
Hmm.
And they'll go, I really like this piece of music. But they go, we've got to get a superior rating. You know,
right.
We've got to get that. We don't want to get a 2 or 3 or 4 or 5. And that motivates them also.
Right, so the contest, the state contests, and that type of thing,
correct?
They give
yeah.
out ones for yeah. superior performance, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and you, as a band director, you obviously, like we talked about earlier, playing the oboe, you play the English horn, you play clarinet as well. You play a whole lot of instruments.
Yeah.
How many instruments do you or does one have to play to do the job you did for 30 years?
Well, when I worked on my bachelor's degree, we had to study 7 different instruments privately and play them in a band. So one semester I was playing trumpet in this band, and we would go through several method books to discuss the type of method book and the problems the trumpets may be starting to have at this point. And then maybe one time it'd be clarinet or tuba or whatever. Plus I had to study string.
Hmm. So you were given a pretty broad education yourself in order to qualify for this kind of position.
Yeah.
And how important is it for you to be able to play a reed instrument? That's what we're talking about, reed instruments today. In terms of being able to direct this ensemble that really is more than half reeds.
Yes.
How important is it for you to understand that technology?
Well, usually the woodwinds are the ones that are the technical players in the band.
Meaning the ones who are the most accomplished?
Well,
or
they play more
the right
notes per beat.
Oh, I see. They have to play more notes.
Yeah. They actually, you know, have fingers that need to move.
Right. Okay.
And so if you don't understand what every instrument, woodwind instrument, is possible of doing, plus all the alternate fingerings, and when you go to play like a high E or F on the flute above the staff, what do you need to do embouchure-wise to make that note sound good and in tune?
Right.
Because if you use the same embouchure, for instance, to play a high F on the flute as you do the fifth line F, it's going to be sharp. You need to maybe roll in a little bit or whatever.
Right. So because the woodwinds have the bulk of the notes for the band arrangements,
it is
important, or it is helpful for you that you were a reed instrument player.
Oh, by all means.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess it would be like the violins in an orchestra. They play more notes per beat than most of the other instruments, and they go longer.
Right. Yeah. So that you're saying for that post, it would be more beneficial to have maybe a string player or someone who understands strings.
That's why they have a concert master.
Mm.
He is like the leader of the string section. He sets what direction they bow.
Right.
And stuff.
Right. But as the reed player, as the band director, you have to be the one to dictate all that for the woodwind players in the orchestra.
I need to be able to turn to the flutes and say, don't use that fingering for that note, that high note. Use this fingering.
Right.
And, well, that takes years of experience.
Right.
You can't learn it all in a bachelor's degree.
Right. And then the brass that you learned, obviously you're able to turn to the brass in the group, mm-hmm. Maybe a third of the group mm-hmm. or less, and you're able to help them as well because mm-hmm. of the education you had as well.
Oh, right. I mean, there's alternate fingerings for all those instruments.
Right.
And to keep the trombones from having to pump that slide so much, you need to know what they are.
And then there's a lot of percussion in a wind band, and so you have to know a little bit about that as well. Yeah. Talk about how you have to talk to them and use what you know in your instruments and what you've learned about them and talk to them.
Like, there's several different places to hit a gong. A gong? I mean, you use a gong maybe once a year if you're lucky, but it all depends. You can hit it in the center and it kind of swells out. You hit it at the... There are these two names on the gong. They're Chinese. They're there to show you where to hit sometimes, and you can prepare, by slightly rolling on that gong and then hit it, and it'll splash more, and how to hit the cymbals and how to play finger cymbals and just where to do the roll on the snare drum.
Right.
Do you do it in the center or out on the edge?
Right. So you have all this woodwind understanding, and then an understanding of all the other instruments down to where to hit the gong, the proper gong technique for the one time you need it every school year.
And you never hit the bass drum in the middle unless you want something really dry.
Right. And then how much of that was you learned that in college, and how much of that you learned that from experience?
I bet I learned about 70-75% after college.
Wow.
Yeah.
School of life.
Yeah. Asking other band directors, asking professional musicians.
Well, thank you, David, for taking the time to talk about this. This has been great.
Loved it.
To close out our Classroom Corner segment, let's hear a famous wind band march written by John Philip Sousa. I think this one ties in well to our segment's discussion for today. This is High School Cadets, performed by the USAF Heritage of America Band.
You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's program has been titled Good Reeds, where we explore the woodwind instruments whose sound is produced with a reed mouthpiece and some of the great music written for these reed instruments. We've discussed the more common orchestral versions of these instruments, but before we close, we need to hear some saxophone, and that will be our dessert today, where we hear an example from the popular or folk tradition to end the program. The saxophone was invented in the mid-19th century, though it's commonly associated with 20th century American jazz or perhaps 1980s pop music. It has never found a permanent place in the orchestra, but is a standard component of military bands or wind bands. It was named after its inventor, Adolphe Sax, and it's made of metal, usually brass, and has a single reed at the mouthpiece for tone production, much like a clarinet. Given its prominence in jazz, let's hear a great example from this tradition. This is more specifically the bebop style, a form of jazz that is highly complex and virtuosic. This is Harry Connick Jr.'s arrangement of a song from the Wizard of Oz musical called Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead. It's from a Grammy-winning album that Harry Connick Jr. released in 2001 called Songs I Heard, featuring songs from movies that he saw as a child. This particular arrangement features a soprano saxophone performed by Branford Marsalis, but you'll also hear a brief moment of the baritone saxophone, the barry sax, the low saxophone, and a small chorus of saxophones. So I hope you enjoy. Remember, you can follow this program on Twitter at MusicForLifePCG.
Let's open up and sing and ring the bells out, ding dong the merry o.
Sing it high.
You have been listening to Music for Life. From the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus, I'm Ryan Malone. Thanks for joining me.